right. Well, I think that since we have a quorum, we are going to get started, and I think that this will be a brief meeting. The main things to talk about are any edits, comments on Chapter 5 of the plan, which is identifying barriers, and the other thing is discussing the last chapter, which is performance measures. Did someone else just join us?
Hey, it's Amy. Sorry I'm late.
That's okay, Amy. I just started. We have those two things to talk about. Why don't we get started with the first items on the agenda, which are approving our past two meeting minutes because we did not have quorum at our June 3rd meeting. So we have to, first for our May 20th meeting minutes, I sent out to everyone, are there any changes to those meeting minutes? All right, hearing none, do we have a motion to approve? So moved. Anyone second it?
I'll second it, Mark.
All right. All those in favor of approving the May 20th meeting minutes?
Aye.
All right, approved. Next, June 3rd meeting minutes. Are there any changes to those meeting minutes? All right, hearing none, does anyone have a motion to approve June 3rd meeting minutes? So moved.
I'll second it again, Mark.
Oh, I'm sorry. I do have one minor change. Just in wording on the second page, the first full paragraph, which is one sentence, where it says committee recommended adding language. I wanted to see if we could just change that to people first language so that it reads programs to be highlighted in this guide are those with the ability to assist people who are elderly and or disabled as opposed to the elderly and disabled.
Yes. Okay. We can definitely do that. I will make that change. Is there a motion to approve given the changes requested?
So moved.
Yes.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Right, great, thanks. I will make that change and get those posted on our website. Okay, so the first order of business is to look at the back of Chapter 5, identifying barriers. And this is obviously a big chapter because it's a very important one. And I think we're trying to be very comprehensive because these issues that are brought up definitely all of them were mentioned by either council members or those stakeholders who testified at the public forums or both. In many cases, it's both. And then this chapter kind of leads into our chapters, both from the cross-agency committee as well as the policy and barriers committee chapters where recommendations are made. So I think that maybe we should just go through four main subsections of the document and to see if we have any thoughts, any changes. So why don't I start with the regulatory requirements and limitations subsection. It's pages 1 through 3. Are there any comments, concerns, edits to the regulatory requirements and limitations section?
I just had one comment. I thought that the summary was really good. The piece I really didn't pick up on is in the inadequate funding for the program. So we talked about how difficult it is for people to get by if they get into subsidized housing and they have SSI only. But I think it would be helpful to add a paragraph just looking at the inability of the programs to accommodate those who meet all of the eligibility criteria, but they can't access a voucher.
So difficulty for the programs to be able to get that person connected to a voucher?
Right, because there are no slots, because the program has been frozen, because they're not taking applications.
Yes, I see what you're saying. So you're referencing the Section 8 voucher program specifically.
Uh-huh, yeah. And then also, just kind of a minor edit, but on housing, the second sentence.
Sorry, which page are you on?
I'm on page 2 under regulatory requirements and limitations.
Uh-huh.
Under the housing section.
Okay, great.
And the second sentence reads, however, federal regulation prohibits Medicaid dollars from being used to pay for rent or utilities. And if you could just insert Medicaid waiver dollars, because obviously the Medicaid beneficiary is expected to use his Medicaid funds to pay for rent and utilities. The Medicaid waiver program does not pay for room and board.
Okay, yeah, I will make sure that we clarify that. Okay, yeah, I will add that in. Thank you. And
just for my own presentation, in what way does the regular Medicaid program help pay for rent?
Pay for housing? The only time I know of when the Medicaid waiver program will pay for housing is if the beneficiary chooses and is eligible for assisted living, adult foster care, a group home. So it's only when they choose those congregate living settings as opposed to independent living. If it's independent living, then they're expected to take care of their own room and board.
My question was about, you said the change, you should change from Medicaid to Medicaid waiver. Is the Medicaid program, not the Medicaid waiver program, but if you're on regular Medicaid, does that pay for rent and housing in any way?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, and I was thinking SSI/Medicaid, but you're right. Medicaid would not pay for room and board. Well, yeah, the Medicaid program would pay for room and board if it's nursing facility.
Yeah, so it's only if it's a non-community-based setting.
Right, right.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Okay, I will make sure I make that addition. In terms of...
So money follows the person... Isn't that the Medicaid dollars that would have been put to the, been given to the nursing home, but it's used for community living?
Well, that program, it doesn't, once you find housing, I don't think that it pays for the housing. I think that it pays the location specialist, find persons in nursing, and transition them. I don't think it pays for the room board.
Oh. I mean, you're looking at the name, money follows the person. If Medicaid dollars pays the nursing home, which is part of the risk, they want to do that once they get
out. It's paying for the services. Money follows the person pays for the services for the person to live in the housing of their choice. I think that's the distinction. Right. Yeah, it's part of the state plan, I believe. Okay, and then... I was thinking, Donnie, about your good point about Section 8 what it comes down to is there's not adequate funding from the federal government to increase the number of Section 8 vouchers to basically alleviate the long waiting list that we have. So thinking that maybe we should put that piece, which is a good piece, I think we need it, put that under the funding limitations subsection that starts on page 5. I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, I think that would work.
Actually, this is Nick. I just have one thought about how to phrase that, and I think that for state agencies, when you start to talk about inadequate funding, it gets to be a little dicey in terms of, you know, why being granted this is federal, but people hear that term and apply it to every level of government. So I was thinking something on the order of looking at the demand exceeding the available funds, something like that, rather than labeling it inadequate.
Okay. Yeah, I can say that. Okay. I will put that in. Okay. So are there any other comments or edits to the regulatory requirements and limitations section?
This is Nick again. I have a bunch of little tiny stuff. I'll just float that around. You know, it's not really worth taking up our time here.
Okay. Definitely.
Phasing and phrasing kind of things.
Yeah. You can just send that by email. And you know, if you want to do direct check changes or if you just want to put comment boxes, either one is fine.
Okay.
Okay. Great. So let's just move on to then the second section, which is administrative limitations and limited coordination. And so this is from page 4 to 5. And the subsections within this are layering funding sources, fragmentation of funding, standardized program application, and federal eligibility requirements. These just came out of our discussions as well as stakeholder feedback. So are there any comments or edits to this section?
I just think that whenever you're referencing stuff like the Medicaid state plan, it's probably important to get this in front of Jonas.
Yes, the Policy and Barriers Committee actually looked at this chapter during their meeting last week.
Oh, okay. So yes. his thoughts the board can catch.
Yes, that's well. Actually, let me clarify. He was not on the call. I asked him to send me any email feedback because he was actually on vacation during last week's call.
Okay.
But I did speak with him this week, and I also received Mark Gold and Jim Hanafee's comments, which since they deal with also the different programs that are available through CMS, so. I think that we got, in terms of wording, we got everything covered from them.
Okay, now that's just my only concern since Jonas has to work with the Medicaid folks.
Yeah. All right. If there are no concerns, we can move to section 3, which is the funding limitation section, and that's from page...
Oh, I'm sorry, Ashley. I did have one more under the prior section.
Okay.
And after federal eligibility requirements, in some cases there are state eligibility requirements. An example is the project access vouchers. They are age restricted. They're available only to people who are under the age of 62. And my understanding is that the reason the state has that policy in place is it used to be a federal requirement, but the federal requirement has been dropped.
Right.
Yet the state has retained that.
Well, and that has, sorry, can I? I only want to interject because this is actually changing as we speak. It's going to our the end of July, or sorry, end of June, June 28th board meeting. A change to this rule is happening, and so we are going to be dedicating a certain amount of our project access vouchers now to persons over the age of 62.
Yay! Consider yourself the recipient of a virtual hug.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great, I think you're right about that, and that we were kind of just using that leftover language from the federal program that we didn't really need, and I think that it was something that not only the consumers, but at the state agency level, Money Follows the Person was definitely pushing for this change as well. So I will, as soon as we get the rule approved by our governing board, I will let you know and get that language to you. But yeah, I agree with you, and we changed it.
But actually, I still think there's probably other state programs other than that one that add restrictions on top of the feds, and if we can somehow get them to limit that, it's you know, that layers of restrictions, and I think you talked about it sometimes in the layer of funding sources, but when there's federal requirements and then we add state requirements or department requirements on top of it, it just makes it that much harder.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. So maybe we can put that, I'm trying to think what's the best place for that. Probably, yeah, you mentioned that the layer or the federal eligibility requirements, and maybe add something about, maybe add to the administrative limitations section.
Right. Or you could even maybe instead of federal eligibility say multiple eligibility requirements and add a sentence suggesting the fact that when a state agency adds on top of the federal, it just makes it that much harder for us to do the work.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I can make that change. I will add that in on page 4.
So, if there's not very many other categories besides federal, you could just drop the word federal and just be inclusive to whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Yeah, but I do so think that it's necessary to point out that, you know, as the money is down the pipeline, where
some of it's out of our control.
Right. Yeah, but yeah, and then some of it is within our control to not try to inhibit. Okay, I will add that section into that section. Okay, great. So we have that taken care of. So moving on to the funding limitations. The funding limitations is the third subsection from page 5 to 7, and the main paragraphs are categorized into administrative funding, federal cuts, time limitations, more information about the Medicaid state plan that's related to funding, and then affordable housing development. Oh, wait, and also, I'm sorry, there's also health care funding and transportation funding on page 7. So this was, there's a lot of funding limitations out there. I mean, let's be honest, we could probably write all day about them. But if there's any categories maybe that I left out or any edits, are there any comments on that section?
Actually, it's Mark. It's obviously, since this document's going to the state legislature, you might want to say the obvious, which is the state of Texas has budget limitations, and, can't just look to the feds and other people as the source of the hard cuts and hard decisions. So do you think that'd be appropriate? I recognize that the state of Texas itself makes budget decisions in these areas. Because your lead-in talks about state and federal sources.
It would be necessary to gather a little bit more background information on this because I know, you know, for TDHCA, I know how much GR we get and how it's approximately 3% of our entire budget.
Right. This report, it's coming this year, and as a matter of fact, in about 18 minutes, I have to go into a major budget meeting where we're going to address the 10% cut. The whole state's facing that, and something's going to get cut. We're now, you know, 5 plus another 10 is getting to the serious level. So I think it's just kind of the obvious statement, but it does probably would be strange.
Right. I agree with you on that. So can I actually ask you a clarifying question?
Mm-hmm.
So the 5% cut was supposed to be on the 2010-2011 biennium?
Yeah, we've already been cut that, yeah.
And then the 10% is looking forward to the 2012-2013 biennium?
Correct. It's in 2 5% stages, and each agency has the option, as they did before, presumably, and I'll find out the details, to argue for exemptions, and then in exceptional items, you can go back, and which every agency will do, including us, and ask for your cut back. But you have to cut, and then that way what they do, and this is what they did with us with the first round of 5% cuts, they just said, thank you, we accept your cuts. Please please reduce your expenditures in the ABS system. And no legislative action, no nothing. It just occurred through, you know, that process of us submitting cuts in a computerized system and they accepting they give us feedback and say we accept your cuts.
Right.
The money's gone.
Yeah, no, I think
and,
that's really
I think you can just say things like, you know, the state funding is often, unfortunately, we all deal with this. It fluctuates with the economic situation in the country. In good times, there's ample funds, and we can fund some extra ideas and some extra generosity. And then tough times, and that cyclical, funding, since we have a balanced budget in Texas, plays havoc with service industry, service agencies, because they don't need cyclical funding. They need counter cyclical funding. So when times are tough, that's when they have more demand on their services. So but you're right. You could write a book on it, but at least there should be a paragraph that addresses the state budget crunch and as well as the cyclical nature of state funding.
Well, I think all of that's true, but I think we're probably better off just alluding to it just by noting that state funding is limited in the face of large demand.
I think we can make a good argument for those service organizations to. In tough, economic climates, that they require, like Mark said, they require even more funding because they're trying to meet a larger demand of consumers that are in a tough spot. And yet, by the nature of the way a tough economic climate goes, your state budget is obviously going to have to be curtailed. So I think that it's kind of a catch-22 in a way, because there's not, that's kind of standard operating procedure for state budgets is that in a tough economic time you cut back. But I think it's worth stating in this section. I definitely do. Great. I will add that section in.
Also, on the first paragraph, administrative funding, we had looked at, I think it was Tipper Grants a number of months ago, and one of the issues that was a deal breaker for us is that TDHCA or the TIBRA program defines administrative costs very differently than most of our other funding sources. And I think with the TIBRA program, there's a required case management piece. And that's considered administrative in nature. And so I think part of the problem is that some programs or perhaps the agency uses a very broad definition of administrative costs that include direct consumer services in the form of case management.
Okay.
And so when we looked at, 10% for a voucher program, and we understood that we were required to do lead surveys and contact people monthly, and then that was all considered administrative, that time, that travel, and so on. There was no way in the world that we could afford to administer the program. And again, with most other programs we do, if it's a direct client service, it's not administrative. Administrative is fringe and indirect and those kinds of overhead expenses.
Okay. So other funding streams are more narrow in their definition, basically, too.
Right.
Okay. So I guess it's kind of the is it maybe we would, craft that language would be to discuss how being more inclusive in the definition spreads the money much more thin. I don't know how to say that. Much more thin. and then basically thinly, and thus creating an obstacle for
right
fighters. Okay, I can put that in.
Or the issue may be that there are many program requirements that are classified as administrative in nature.
Okay. Okay. I will add that in to that paragraph.
And then the other issue that we ran into, I'm not sure if this is still the case, but my understanding is that TIGRA vouchers are not available statewide.
That's true. It's based on what local organization applies to be the contractor.
Right, and that in some parts of the state there are no providers. So I think that might be worth stating as well, that it's kind of a patchwork.
Mm. So, yeah, I mean, maybe that's kind of a larger point is about the geography of many services is really dependent on having that local organization, that local capacity for someone to be the provider there. And a lot of places in the state, we don't have that local capacity.
Like Dallas. I don't think the city of Dallas is covered.
Really?
Yeah. The Dallas Housing Authority used to have it, and I think that their funds were deobligated.
Okay.
And that nobody else would take it.
Okay. Okay.
So that issue really is about statewide consistency of programs and funding.
Right.
If you live in one area, you might do well. You live in another, forget you.
Yeah.
You just have to get by. It's a lot like the same.
Yeah. But I think that we can add that in. I mean, we sort of talk about the geographic dichotomy a little bit in the consumer barrier section, but I think that maybe talking about it as well in the how our funding actually works across the state is a good part to teach too. Okay, I will add that in. Thank you very much. Are there any other comments on the funding limitations section? All right. Why don't we move on to the final section, which is consumer barriers, which goes from page 7 to 10. These barriers, the kind of sub-paragraphs are access to transportation, rural access to services, affordable housing, or housing affordability for consumers, program complexity, communication and outreach. And I thought that it was kind of good to end with this one because I think that we then pick up in the, if not the next chapter, the chapter after that with the two chapters that deal with the education assistance for local entities as well as the cross education of state agencies that help to address grant complexity as well as communication and outreach. So I thought it was good to kind of end here because then we pick up with the pieces, the chapters that we have already discussed and written. Are there any comments, concerns?
Let's see, this is Mark. I was trying to think of where this would fit and whether it should fit maybe under housing affordability to consumers, but just looking at the broader picture of the barriers, I was trying to think of I don't know if we've really
talked as a separate section of how we would address the cost of housing or housing services. Is there a way to lower that cost? We talk about the ability to pay for it, and we talk greatly about the ability of people's income and then the programs and all, but another component is addressing the ways to make the services less expensive, whether that's efficiencies or whether that's new models or anything like that. And it's kind of the other side of the solution. You know, either kind of like either pay more, you know, get some money and somehow pay the current ongoing cost of the services, or you also, and I know this is a nationwide issue and debate, but the cost of the services, whether it's housing or whatever, is important as far as a barrier. You know, if you can lower the cost, you can increase the, you can reduce a barrier, so it's not just increasing the resources. It might be, see what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah.
When you address a barrier, there's two ways of handling it. It's, you know, it's like buying a house. You either get more money to pay for the house, or you get them to lower the price of the house. But both are components to making the barrier less, or removing the barrier. The whole cost of the services, whether it's housing, health, or whatever. And that's just not a, you know, I don't know if that deserves a separate component, but I think fundamentally it is one of the key components to lowering barriers, is addressing the cost of the services you're trying to provide.
I know on the housing side, I mean, we did have a couple of stakeholders who were developers discuss difficulties in just having their numbers check out and make it a financially feasible development if they try to do, as you know, deep subsidies to meet those that are the very low income of 30% area median income and below. And so I know that we did discuss that as a barrier in terms of the development side, just trying to meet your break even as the developer or the operator of the affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we really talked about it on a consumer side of, I think it's because maybe it's just because it's so obvious that if it were more affordable, more people would get it.
Well, not necessarily. The consumer often can't really control it. It just has to be, you know, I mean, intrinsically, if it's, you know, if there's a way to make the service available cheaper, whether that's, you know, regardless of what you're doing, you know, is, that's presumably what the whole people out there, you know, in the economy try every day. Businesses try to make their product better and cheaper, you know, so that they can increase their market. But it just, you know, I kind of come from an economic perspective, and I know that the cost of the services do affect the barrier. And I don't necessarily have an answer as to how you lower the cost of some of these services. And I know in healthcare that's been a debate for the whole nation. But it just struck me as just worthy at least of a comment that one of the barriers is, it can be, one of the barriers is the cost of the services.
Well, on the other hand, we've identified, and this is a very real barrier out there, I know for sure, is that cost actually is too low, because when we're talking about people who work for people, direct delivery, like personal assistants, the pay is so low for them, it's hard to get, one of the barriers is hard to get quality people to work for you.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to get quality people to come and stay. And,
mm-hmm.
because they're making minimum wage, or and they have no benefits, and in that way, the services are actually costing too little to be able to have quality services. That then that turnover rate and all that creates a whole new barrier.
Yeah, that's a different perspective. Yeah, that you're at least addressing the cost of the services component.
anyway, it's just, it's thought, I mean, I know that I realize that could be a book, and I'm not even sure what we've heard that would offer a solution to addressing the cost of services, but I do know that whether it's health care and presumably housing, to the extent that people can figure out different models or different solutions that lower the cost, then that is definitely a reduction. That was my main point.
Yeah, I think I hear you on that one.
Because we're really attacking from an economic model. We're only addressing barriers from a resources. How do you afford to buy the new car? How do you afford to buy the house? How do you afford to pay someone for your child care? And, there's one way is to let the pension higher salaries, and the other is, more efficient options that let people have more for less, which is a fundamental, whole market discussion, which I don't think we need to get into great lengths, but I just wanted to raise it as if an economist were reading it, I think they would raise that point.
Okay.
It's just a thought, because we have only addressed the barriers from a, we need more money as opposed to,
Yeah. No, I see what you're saying, and I think that we have to try to figure out how we would help phrasing that in here, but I think you're right that it is there is another side to the barriers that we are addressing.
Yeah.
In this chapter is identifying barriers is what you're saying then, that services are barriers to services and that they cost too much?
Yeah. Well, any service delivery, you could have I'm familiar with rural transportation. If you have to, if your model is buying a bus and going out 30 miles to pick up somebody, that's a pretty, you can calculate the cost of that. And then if there's another model there's just different ways to provide a service that may be cheaper. And that's on the consumer level, that's what drives the whole economy. We see something we like and we look at the price and we compare it and we make choices. So that's all I was getting at, that the cost of the services is the You can change the barriers by changing the cost as well as by giving people more money to pay for the cost. Because all delivery systems are not equally the same. They're not equal cost. But I honestly don't have enough knowledge in that area to really write it. I just, especially on healthcare services, I know that the whole nation is debating how to lower the cost of services. That's a huge component of the reducing the barrier of healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And I just hate to miss out on. And if people don't think, maybe they just think it's intrinsically obvious, but it's from an economic perspective, it is part of the equation.
Well, it could be part of the conclusion to this chapter is to say, moving forward, how our state addresses the provision of services and housing looking forward, we could be also looking at different models of provision of that type of assistance. It could be something where we acknowledge that there is that side of things as we're wrapping up. I don't know. Because I think that because what you're talking about is kind of an overarching theme rather than a theme that goes specifically into one of these.
Well, it would cover both sides. The barrier would be addressed through the recommendations, just like with healthcare. I'll stick on that since that's in everyone's mind. If you're trying to address the cost of services, obviously there's a million ideas on how and what model will drive down those services, the cost of those services, and it's to be determined, but at least you ought to know that one of your goals is not simply to
to raise more money to pay for the health care services. It might be actually to develop a model of delivering health care services that's reduced the cost, and therefore you can win on both counts. So sticking with that analogy, that's both addressing the barrier as well as the ultimate recommendations. So I'll leave that for you to think about, Ashley.
So we can figure out where we can meet.
I'm going to have to run here directly and go figure out how to cut 10% out of my budget.
Okay.
So, but I don't want to rush the rest of y'all. I've got a couple minutes and then I have to run.
Okay, well, why don't we wrap up this discussion if there are any other comments on this, on Chapter 5, and say that, you know, let me know now or send me an email. But if you guys don't mind, maybe we should move on to the developing performance measures discussion. So just to give you guys some background, this chapter on developing performance measures was also put before the Policy and Barriers Committee in their conference call last Thursday. And, you know, we kind of had a discussion about, is it really, even though it's a statutory directive, is there really a way at this point for us to develop performance measures? Because, you know, for one, the council doesn't really have the authority to implement or be the decision makers on any of the recommendations that we are putting forth. It would be those decision makers either at the, you know, governing board or commission level of state agencies or the state legislature that would be looking at these recommendations and deciding whether or not to pursue any of them. And so we talked about how, you know, at this point, we would kind of be in the, you know, a waiting process to see, you know, if these ideas, you know, someone decides to take these ideas and run with them that has the ability to implement these recommendations. At that point, we'd be able to kind of see what kind of performance measures we could just come up with. But I think that the just in terms of the Policy and Barriers Committee discussion, I think they had a hard time grappling with the way in which we could have a performance measure. So I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on that. I also talked to my Deputy Executive Director, Brooke Boston, about this, and you know, she kind of had the same thought process where, you know, this is our very first biennial plan, so this is our first set of recommendations, so it might behoove us to kind of say, you know, looking forward to the future, once this has been put out and we have the opportunity to see where it goes, then we can start tracking the success of recommendations.
Well, actually, this is Nick. This is my suggestion. We clearly need to establish, I think, a baseline. And I think the thing that we could do to do that that causes the least heartache among the agencies would be to look at performance measures that they're already required to submit or things that they already count. You know, sort of get a feel for that, and then maybe make some suggestions, you know, along the lines for further thinking about the kinds of things that you've put under possible performance measure recommendations. I mean, we could give some thought of that, I think, in terms of suggestions, but I think the easiest way to look at a baseline would be to look at what agencies are required to count or do count at present.
Okay.
And maybe identify some of those that could tell us something if we look at them over time.
Okay. Any other thoughts on this? Or any agreement, disagreement with what Nick was recommending? Okay. Yeah, I think that, you know, unfortunately, this would need to be something that would be more on the state agency representative side of things. Like, we need to kind of see if we can get some consensus from those who represent an agency that has required performance measures. And I mean, I understand what you're saying, Nick, that maybe if I was able to get from the LBB what's already required to see maybe what's missing, or to see where we could start from.
Well, I think as a first cut, there's a series of performance measures that may not get anywhere near housing at DSHS, but that are in the appropriations bill. And then the budget offices, I think, it's my impression, have some additional stuff that they communicate with LDP about.
Yeah, that's true. I can look to the general appropriations bill to see what would be relevant for council.
And then on top of that, there, on all of these federal grants, there's stuff that has to be reported to the federal government that is essentially, I would think, an open record. Anything beyond, if we start looking at new performance requirements at this point, we're going to get a lot of pushback on programs.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the sentiment that the Policy and Barriers Committee had as well.
This is Amy. I agree with that. However, most of the performance measures that you're talking about are all going to be very specific to the agency, and they're all going to be program-related on how the programs are succeeding, where all of this is what kind of progress have we made in getting the agencies to work together, which are totally different, and not necessarily what's already being reported, but I'm not sure of how to gather it without creating more work that does cause the extensive pushback. So, I don't know.
What's our deadline on coming up with performance measures?
Well, I don't know if there's necessarily a deadline. I mean, this is, it's a statutory directive. However, there isn't anything that's written into the legislation because I think that what we've realized is that certain requirements that were written in the statute are ones that will take longer in terms of the time frame than we have for this to turn in this very first biennial plan. And that because this council is supposed to keep interacting and creating updates to these biennial plans, I'm not exactly sure if we have a specific deadline for each statutory directive, or we're supposed to try to address as many as we can in the biennial plan. I mean, I honestly can't tell you. I don't know if I have an answer.
I think Amy's point is well taken, but I'm not sure we're at the point where we have anything that we can quantify. I think that that section might be a little bit of narrative in terms of, well, these are the things that we're setting up, and the things that maybe, in terms of whatever it is we decide we want to count, that we're looking at counting, but it takes a little operationalization to figure out what it is that's actually important. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, I think about kind of getting back to the, at this point in the game, and this point of this council's activities and existence, is it possible for us to have definitive performance measures?
I think you could. I think you could come up you know, maybe we should come up with some really high level ones, because to me, what the user system measure is, are we creating efficiencies within the, you know, between the state agencies? Are we, you know, improving that communication? The things that it talks about, I think, you know, since so much of this came out of a government efficiency report and the fact that it wasn't efficient because they weren't working together, to me, that's what the outcome needs to be, is are we more efficient? Are we working together better? Are we moving forward on those things? And maybe we can have some real high-level ones that get more detailed as it goes, you know, for 2 years from now in the next report.
Okay. So when you say high-level, you mean,
I don't know, very broad. I'd have to think about it. Actually, I really hadn't thought about what they might be. Like the streamlined regulatory and administrative definitions, to me, that would be a huge plus in creating efficiency and communication.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that would be huge.
So, but you think that it would remain more in that narrative form?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Okay. Okay. I mean, I think that, and this is actually kind of getting back to something that the Policy and Barriers Committee discussed, was that, in a way, you know, what the kind of things that we could come up with for this chapter at this point in time would be in a, like, sort of like our, more of like goals or benchmarks,
mm-hmm,
than they would be actual performance measures, which I think is okay at this point.
Right, right. And that may be what I mean when I say high level, but
yeah. Okay, I think that's kind of a common idea across the two committees about maybe, you know, having some type of broad, higher level, you know, goals or benchmarks to bring forth in this plan, this very first plan, and then perhaps in the future being able to be more specific and detailed and perhaps operationalize those benchmarks a bit further. Okay. Okay, great.
In terms of constructing the document, actually, I don't know if this would be worth anything at all, but, you know, it might be useful to conceptualize them instead of, from a planning perspective, instead of performance measures at this time, but more as sort of goals and objectives.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we could, every 2 years, take a look at whether we meet those goals or not whether we meet them, but the progress we make toward meeting them.
Right.
Those goals and objectives, and if there are numbers that look useful that we can produce without causing too much heartache, then that might be a way forward.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I think that that kind of, you know, is the direction that we can take, you know, at this point in time, that would hopefully, at least set us down a path for future biennial plans. And so I can write up the goals and objectives and goals, objectives, benchmarks, however we want to label them. I can write those up. And, you know, obviously this would be more a very brief chapter, but that's okay. I will definitely make sure I bring those to you guys next time so we can discuss them. So I think that's pretty much, I mean, unless there are any other comments on this discussion, I think that's pretty much what, you know, what the Policy and Barriers Committee decided to do, is that maybe we'll have some bold objectives this time around, and I can craft that before our next meeting.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Sounds good, Ash.
Okay. Are there any other comments in terms of our next steps? Our last conference call is going to be July 1st, Thursday, July 1st. So that's, we're wrapping up. And as a reminder to everyone, we have a full council meeting on Friday, July 9th. It's kind of a working meeting to look through the entire draft of the biennial plan. And if we need to have any further discussions as an entire council, we can do that. So that's July 9th. And I'll be sending out an agenda and the logistical details for that meeting next week. And I will be contacting all of the governor appointees about travel arrangements at the beginning of next week as well. And one more thing. For our final meeting on July 1st, our final committee conference call on July 1st, I'm going to try to bring some draft chapters that were things that we didn't really need to talk about during these calls because we had discussed them previous, such as best practices, and maybe we can have some further discussion on if there's any tweaking to do about the best practices chapter. And then there's also a chapter that is on identifying existing sources of funding. And I think that we touched on that a little bit, but maybe beefing up that chapter a bit as well. So I will definitely be sending those out to you guys for our final meeting.
Sure.
All right, great. Well, thank you guys so much for attending the call, and have a good weekend, and I will talk to you guys all on July 1st.